Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sebree.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Local officials are working to influence national environmental policy in light of threats from the new administration.
One of the most important bills from this year's Colorado legislative session was signed into law this week.
The Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority changed some guidelines that could affect applicants for employee housing.
And artwork installed in roundabouts has stirred up some controversy in three local communities.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Glenwood Springs is preparing for the closure of the Grand Avenue Bridge. This week, there's a preview of the road ahead, and it's being repaved, Wyatt Orm reports.
Crews in downtown Glenwood will be grinding away at old asphalt, then repaving roughly a whole block near City Hall. This is in preparation for the bridge closure in August. Midland will be the only way in and out of town, and therefore will see an unprecedented amount of traffic. Towards the end of this week, crews will narrow Midland Avenue to one lane as they repave. This will take longer, probably about 2 weeks. At exit 116, I-70's eastbound on-ramp is closed each morning, Monday through Friday, from 6 until 9. The Grand Avenue Bridge is the largest infrastructure project on the western slope in 25 years. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Liz Chapman from the Aspen Environmental Health Department has been appointed to a state commission that regulates trash and hazardous waste. As Elizabeth reports, it complements her local work.
Chapman and others on the Colorado Solid and Hazardous Waste Commission make the rules for safely disposing waste. She says it's important work.
You throw your stuff in the trash can, it goes away, and you don't think much more about it. After that, well, that's possible because of the work that everyone's doing behind the scenes to make sure that those facilities are run in a way that protects the environment.
Chapman brings real-world experience from her work to create local policy, including recent efforts to divert more construction and demolition waste from the Pitkin County landfill. In August, consultants on that project will present to City Council on potential solutions for how to reduce trash. Most ideas include financial penalties for throwing away construction material and building a new sorting facility to help repurpose or recycle more.
Governor John Hickenlooper signed the state's roughly $26 billion budget into law last Friday. Benta Berkland has more.
The budget received widespread support, even though it didn't put as much money into key programs as many wanted. Lawmakers were able to work around a more than a $500 million shortfall and avoid deep cuts to hospitals. Governor John Hickenlooper says the compromise bill to avoid those cuts was crucial to the overall budget. A bipartisan committee crafts the budget, and lawmakers praise the model for allowing the budget to come together in time and in balance. It goes into effect July 1st. Hickenlooper didn't veto any parts of the budget. Healthcare makes up the largest share of spending, followed by education. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
One of the most significant pieces of legislation to come out of this year's session was signed into law on Tuesday. Senate Bill 267 avoided deep cuts to hospitals and put about $2 billion into road funding. Again, Benta Berkland.
The expansive measure was aimed at helping rural Colorado and preventing an effective $500 million cut to hospitals. It also removed a hospital fee from counting against the state's revenue growth limit to free up more money in the state budget. Republican Senator Jerry Sonnenberg of Sterling was the main sponsor.
We can't continue to balance the budget on the back of hospitals.
The bipartisan bill, which is separate from the annual state budget, was the subject of intense negotiations between the Republican-controlled Senate and Democratic House. It will also allow the state to sell and lease back buildings and put that money into roads. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Recent strides from arts organizations are putting basalt on the arts and culture map. Here to talk about them is arts reporter Claire Woodcock. Hi, Claire.
Hey, Kristen.
So what's going on in basalt?
Honestly, a lot. But let's start with the Basalt Public Arts Commission. It's this organization created by the town and funded by a new 1% for the arts ordinance. And in June, BPAC, we're going to call it BPAC from now on, will launch its inaugural program called Confluence 3, and it's going to be a 6-year series of 3 temporary public art exhibits. So different sculptures will be installed every 2 years. The first collection of sculptures are being installed this week throughout different parts of town, and there's going to be 5 of them.
Do we know anything about these sculptures?
So the artist's name is Wynn Earl Bazell Jr., and the installation is called Modio 2.0. Denver Art Museum had originally commissioned Bissell's work in 2016. Now he's bringing it to Bissell, and it's supposed to symbolize the connectivity between the different parts of the town throughout the different pieces of this larger body of work.
Very cool. So what else is happening in Bissell?
Well, the town council voted 6-0 last week to grant a 99-year lease to the arts campus at Willits, or TICA, as we at the station like to call it. So if all goes as planned, Bissell is expected to have a full performing arts center operating in Willits Town Center by July 2022. There will be a public hearing June 13th before it's finalized, which means a temporary performing arts center, cleverly called The Temporary, will open in the ground floor of the Valley View Medical Building at Willits on August 1st. It's a smaller venue, so it's going to attract some smaller acts like local bands and comedians in the beginning, but it's expected to attract larger acts moving forward.
So why is there all this growth on the Bissell art scene right now?
Well, what I'm hearing from folks close to these projects is that Bissell wants to become a Mid-Valley mecca for the arts, to bring in more artists and stimulate economic growth. Geographically, Bissell is very spread out, and the arts community is attempting to bridge those different subdivisions of the town together to unify and grow its art programming to attract art lovers from Down Valley, Up Valley, and everywhere else in the world.
Claire, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Esteemed jazz professor Ronald Carter is teaching at Aspen Middle School this week. Claire Woodcock has the details.
Professor Carter literally wrote the book on jazz education. The textbooks are popular throughout colleges. Steve Helt, a former student of Carter's and Aspen School District's instrumental music director, says it's important for kids to have an authentic experience in learning the art of jazz.
And I want them to not learn this from a book or from a recording, but to experience it in person. Having the kids work with someone who is the jazz pedagogue. I mean, just one morning has taken them so far.
Carter will lead a concert with the Aspen Middle School's 5th grade band and the AMS Big Band on Thursday, June 1st at 6 p.m. at the District Theater. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The Roaring Fork River is on Colorado's list of impaired rivers, so City of Aspen officials are working on a plan to improve the health of the waterway. So, Elizabeth, you've reported that officials have identified three major concerns for the river. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked in the past about low flows and stormwater runoff. So what's the third?
Well, there's been damage to the riparian areas, which are those areas right along the banks of the river. And a lot of that damage comes from homes and businesses that are built too close to it.
How is that damaging to the river?
Well, anyone who's floated or walked along the river as it passes through town knows that the banks are just kind of lined with homes and businesses. So those beautiful manicured lawns that run right up to the edge of the riverbank look really nice, but they've replaced the natural vegetation, which is really important in the health of the river. There should be diverse plants there, things like sedges and rushes and cottonwoods, aspens, things that would naturally grow along a riverbank, because those plants can stabilize the riverbank and help prevent erosion. They also act as natural filters for things like sediment and runoff and pesticides from yards. And then finally, those plants and trees that grow along the banks provide habitat for insects and fish in the river. They provide shade that helps control the water temperature and lots of other important things.
So a lot of the river runs through private land. What can the city really do?
Yeah, right. So that's the challenge. With new development or redevelopment, the city can require setbacks from the stream, but the city really doesn't have authority over private land that's already been developed. So they're looking right now at some outreach efforts. Here's April Long, who heads up the Clean River Program.
I think that people want to live on the river because they love the river and they don't have any idea that they have done any damage to it or that a previous homeowner had done any damage to the riparian area, and that if they were aware of that fact, they may seek ways that they could improve the situation.
Okay, so does that mean the city will just hope people will fix this on their own?
Yes and no. April tells me that there are ways to incentivize homeowners. So some of that might be financial, like maybe sharing some of the cost of improvements to riparian areas. And then in this kind of rather taboo ground in Aspen, they may be talking about allowing property owners a little bit extra square footage or a little bigger footprint to build on if they build those homes further away from the river. Hmm. But, you know, it's not totally clear what will motivate people to do some work to restore those damaged areas or what kinds of incentive programs would actually work or be legal. They kind of have a lot of stuff to figure out.
Okay, Aspen Public Radio's environment reporter, Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thanks, Elizabeth.
You bet.
The Roaring Fork River through Aspen is listed as impaired, and Aspen City officials are developing a plan to improve its health. They are asking for community feedback through the end of the month. As of Tuesday, the state's oil and gas operators should have inspected all pipelines within 1,000 feet of occupied buildings. In Garfield County, it's unclear how many of those there are. Wyatt Orm reports.
Earlier this month, Governor John Hickenlooper demanded oil and gas operators check their wells and pipelines near buildings. This was after two men died in a gas explosion caused by a leaky flow line. The operators also need to give the state the locations of their flow lines, and there are currently no maps showing where these run. State data suggests there are over 1,700 oil and gas wells within 1,000 feet of buildings in Garfield County. Each one of these has at least one flow line. However, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says this data deserves skepticism. It has not independently vetted the GIS coordinates the data relies on. Oil and gas operators now have until June 30th to test flow lines within 1,000 feet of buildings. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
New guidelines have been approved regarding asset caps for those applying for Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority residences. Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bektesh covers housing issues and is here to explain. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
So let's start with how applicants qualify for that employee housing.
APCHA uses a three-prong evaluation system to determine if an applicant qualifies for housing. The first is occupancy, how many people would be living in the space. Second is income, how much money you earn, and this has to be within Pitkin County year-round, at least 30 hours a week. The third is assets. How much other wealth you have to your name, and that's what we're dealing with here. An asset cap says you can't be worth more than a certain amount to qualify for a category of APCHA housing.
So what's changed with those asset cap guidelines?
Asset caps were recently raised, meaning applicants can essentially now have more in the bank. So they also established a clear statement as to why assets are even taken into consideration and a clear equation for determining what asset caps should be. Now, that equation is applied differently in the different categories, but if you are in the lowest or poorest category of applicant, that's category one. Previously, you could have $100,000 net worth, now $130,000.
So what else is happening with the Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority with regional housing?
I might be a little ahead of myself here, but I actually think some big changes are coming. Some are out in the open. Next week, the APCHA board is holding a public hearing on changing the income categories for housing applicants. So that's kind of a step two in a whole reworking of APCHA qualifications. But there's also a little bit of behind-the-scenes activity that I have my eye on.
Ooh.
There's talk led by private citizens of establishing a regional housing authority. So this would be all Valley communities joining together to create an affordable housing system. Hmm. Aspen has already said that they are out. They have their hands full enough. They've got a good thing going here just within their own jurisdiction. But Pitkin County is undecided. If Pitkin County joins the regional housing authority, it's hard to imagine them also staying a part of APCHA. And there's other little cracks in that partnership that I've been reporting on over the years. Last year, the talk of securing public money for aging units was killed by a vote by the county. And they are philosophically at odds with the city. PITCO only wants urban development. They don't want any housing built on any county land. Whereas I think the city understands that more affordable housing is an asset worth trading a little bit of government land for. If PITCO joins the regional group, then they all of a sudden have more urban centers to build in without compromising their goals of land conservation. My guess is we will see some of that conflict get addressed head on this year.
To listen to the rest of Kristen and Allison's conversation or to hear other deep dives into current Roaring Fork Valley issues with members of our news team, subscribe to Aspen Public Radio's podcast, The Dial. To listen, go to aspenpublicradio.org. Under the Your News tab, click on The Dial.
Local governments in the Roaring Fork Valley have long worked to lower greenhouse gas emissions, protect wilderness areas from overuse, and keep water in our rivers. For the first time in many local elected officials' tenure, these environmental priorities are under threat from the White House. Elizabeth asked local officials how they are working to influence national policies.
On November 9, 2016, the day after the election, Pitkin County Commissioner Rachel Richards started thinking about federal policy.
Katie, bar the door. You know, everything's on the table now. Everything you ever thought was settled law or settled policy is on the table.
Aspen Mayor Steve Scadron takes a similar view on the importance of being in the trenches locally.
We have to do everything we can at a local level to ensure that the work we've already done doesn't go for naught.
And across the Roaring Fork Valley, local governments are making sure they have a voice in the national conversation. It takes many forms, everything from writing attention-grabbing editorials to paying lobbyists in D.C. Garfield County has spent $30,000 per year for the last 3 years to contract a lobbyist, Robert Wiedner, in Washington, D.C., to work on key issues the commissioners identify. Garfield County Commissioner John Martin lists a few examples of how that money has been spent.
We lobbied not to list the sage grouse as endangered. We also lobbied not to do the restrictive land use control that the BLM was proposing.
Often, lobbying efforts end in a mixed bag or some sort of compromise. In this case, it was a win for the Garfield County commissioners that sage grouse are not listed as endangered. But Martin says the restrictions on development on public lands near the bird's habitat are too strict. Still, Martin says lobbying is an effective tool.
It has been worth every penny. It has been disappointing sometimes. But we, as I say, we're a stubborn lot. We don't give up. We continue down the path.
Officials in Pitkin County and the city of Aspen say they take a different approach, one that starts closer to home. Ashley Pearl is the climate action expert with the city of Aspen. She says her department does two things.
And only two things. One, we do local action. So we put in programs on the ground. And two, we're policy advocates. So we push for bigger action at a bigger scale.
And that often means joining statewide organizations. Both Aspen and Pitkin County spend thousands of dollars each year on memberships in groups like the Mountain Pact. This is an association of ski towns across the West that keeps an eye on legislation. Staff and elected officials choose what they see as the most pressing issues, like recent congressional efforts to repeal regulations on methane emissions. Pitkin County and Aspen both broke out pen and paper to voice their opposition. Pearl explains.
Our shorter winters and our reduced snowpack are a product of global greenhouse gas emissions, so we have to fight the fight for reduced global greenhouse gas emissions.
Climate action is top priority for the city of Aspen. Mayor Steve Scadron is part of an international coalition called the Compact of Mayors. Members of that group pledge to reduce emissions in their communities, and Scadron has recreated that compact on a smaller scale in Colorado.
And then we would perhaps create this grassroots movement that could then influence policy at state and national levels.
Earlier this month, Aspen hosted representatives from over 40 Colorado communities. 27 pledged to ask their local communities to join Scadron's program, including all Roaring Fork Valley cities and Pitkin and Eagle counties. Garfield County did not attend. According to Pitkin County Commissioner Rachel Richards, forming associations of like-minded communities is important. Pitkin County recently worked to create a new group of counties when the statewide organization, Colorado Counties Incorporated, did not reflect local interests.
We are very outnumbered. That group tends to really support things like the transfer of public lands to the states, quote, reforming the Endangered Species Act, or even getting rid of the Antiquities Act, which is how monuments are nominated and designated by the president.
Richards helped to start a new association called Counties and Commissioners Acting Together, or CCAT. This group represents many progressive and mountain governments, and it's beginning to gain influence. Richards says it's not just up to elected officials to represent community values.
Citizen group activism is just as important as government activities.
And either way,
it's about unified fronts and unified activities.
And maintaining a voice in a changing national conversation. listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
County's plan for dealing with natural hazards is due for an update. As Elizabeth reports, the 2017 edition will consider climate change impacts.
Counties are required to update their hazard mitigation plans every 5 years. This is meant to reduce risks and help governments respond to natural disasters like landslides, flooding, and wildfire. For the first time, Pitkin County is considering how climate change could exacerbate those hazards, especially fire. Pitkin County's emergency manager, Valerie McDonald, explains.
Wildfire season is getting much longer than it used to be. Fires are burning hotter and longer, more intensely than ever before.
This will also be the first time that dangers from dams are included. There are two high-hazard dams in the county, Rudi and Grizzly. The first discussion is next Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. at the Aspen Fire Station and is open to the public.
Joe DeSalvo is Pitkin County Sheriff. He was recently contacted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The county is on a list with five others in Colorado who allegedly are going to lose some federal funding. The issue, it seems, is the recent stance Pitkin County took about being a welcoming community for immigrants. To learn more, we turn to Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm. So Wyatt, my first question is, why Pitkin County? Why are they being singled out? It seems like law enforcement throughout the valley has taken a similar stand, but they aren't on this list.
That's true. And we don't know for sure. I spoke with the county manager, John Peacock, and he basically said ICE hasn't given the county an explanation yet. We should say that Sheriff DeSalvo was contacted by ICE, and ICE basically told him, you're on this list, but the list has not been published yet. What we do know is that at the end of April, Pitkin County commissioners passed a resolution that affirmed the county is a, quote, welcoming community for immigrants. They don't think that being in the country without papers is a crime, and they don't think that the sheriff should be spending time enforcing immigration law. At least the officials that I've talked to have basically said they think they're being singled out because of the public stance that they took, because they were vocal about basically wanting to limit their cooperation with ICE.
So ICE already has a presence in the valley. They have an office in Glenwood.
That's exactly right.
So Pitkin County has said they won't cooperate with immigration authorities at all?
No. So, I mean, Pitkin County will comply with ICE in a variety of circumstances. If ICE brings them a warrant for someone's arrest and that warrant is signed by a judge, of course they're going to comply. What they won't comply with is if there's no due process, if there's been no judicial review. And this is no different than any county in Colorado. Every single county in Colorado has basically said they're not going to honor ICE detainers, basically ICE asking them to hold someone, unless those are signed by a judge. And the issue here, of course, is the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, so being on this federal list means that some federal funds are being withheld. So how much are those and what are they used for?
These are called SCAP funds that are being withheld. And so when Pitkin County holds an undocumented immigrant in jail, the federal government will reimburse them. And it's not that much money. Over the past 5 years, Pitkin County has received about $80,000. Last year, they received about $6,000. So I think all things considered, this is not an enormous sum. But nonetheless, this does have a lot of officials in Pitkin County pretty riled up.
Okay, Wyatt, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Along with improving safety and traffic flow, roundabouts are also used as de facto gallery spaces. But as new public art pops up in these places, so do questions and complaints. Claire Woodcock made some rounds in the valley and brings us this report.
Of course, every town is a little different, but they all seem to have gotten stuck in the same controversies. First, the public wants a say on their public art. Also, there are actual safety concerns. And then there's this funny collaboration between traffic engineers, government officials, and artists. So let's start in Silt.
where a new centerpiece was installed last month.
Statuary is about 7 feet tall, two blue herons standing in what appear to be some reeds, similar to what you would find on the Colorado River.
That's Rick Alouse, Silt's mayor. He describes the new sculpture as part of the town's effort to rebrand itself. You see, the former centerpiece depicted a nude rock climber, and it became the butt of a lot of jokes. Locals called it the Round a Butt. But Alouse says there's another reason the first sculpture was so problematic.
The previous centerpiece was so large that it was difficult to see cars that might have been coming from the other direction to see what was in the roundabout and what wasn't.
Alouse says that the Colorado Department of Transportation did not like the old statue because it obstructed drivers' views. But Tracy Truelove, the Valley's regional communications manager for CDOT, says sometimes adding artwork can actually increase the safety of roundabouts.
But a lot of the art you see that does go in tends to actually make a situation where the line of sight across the roundabout is protected.
Meaning that drivers actually pay more attention to the cars adjacent to them rather than those across the way. In order for the centerpiece to work, it can't be distracting. Like, no butts. Truelove says this creates a dynamic where the traffic engineers actually become curators to a degree.
That's another thing that's kind of funny about our policy and our guideline for integrating art is that it can be broad, right? Art's a very subjective medium.
The art part of the process, Truelove says, is up to local municipalities and can sometimes seem like it's happening behind closed doors. Usually a philanthropist will commission an artist of their choice to create a work, then present it to the town as a gift. The town can either decide to accept it or reject it. That's where Truelove sees the most passionate public response.
And it definitely seems like something that local municipalities like to have to highlight or showcase their town.
James Searles is a modernist sculptor based in Carbondale. He designed the town's roundabout sculpture called Sewing the Future, installed in 2014.
There very easily could be, and often is, controversy between an arts council and the artist, let's say. Not on a personal level, but on a formality level of how it was all handled and who introduced it and how it was voted on and when it was approved to go to the next step.
He says it's important for both the town and the artist to be cognizant of what is being placed in a roundabout.
It's there speaking for a bigger group of people than just that artist that made it. So meaning, content, symbolism, metaphoric realities, those all have to come to bear. They should all be discussed. The town should know what they're getting.
Searles says not everyone showed signs of approval.
I don't think that's unusual, to tell you the truth.
Groundwork for a new installation began last week in a Snowmass Village roundabout. Travis Elliott is the assistant town manager. On one hand, there were national regulations at play.
Sightline distances, how big it is, all of that was taken into consideration.
But also, the public wanted a say in the design. The piece, sculpted by South Dakota artist laureate Dale Claude Lamphere, has become an object of controversy among residents. The sculpture, made of stainless steel and creek rock, is meant to capture the beauty and speed of downhill skiing. But locals say the representation of the town should have been designed by a local. Again, Elliott points out that the public officials were the curators in this process.
The town went through a lengthy public input process through our Snowmass Arts Advisory Board, who is a group of volunteers of the community, and the Planning Commission, who is also a group of volunteers. And they ultimately recommended to the town council that we accept the sculpture.
The piece, working title Double Black Diamond, is scheduled for installation in July. Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Zevery. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. This week, Allison Bechtesh talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.